Welcome to the Venus Index podcast. I'm John Barbin, and with me is Tanya Enriquez, and she placed second in our open contest. And I also had the chance to meet Tanya in Las Vegas. So I know that you started a thread in the forum, and you have some ideas of what people wanted to hear. And I'm trying to each of these interviews is going to end up being its own thing, anyways. So I guess we'll just kind of go back and forth between what you have some ideas, and I have a couple of ideas that I'm going to ask you regardless. So before we get into some of the berries and other things, can you give us a history of your, I guess, brief history as it pertains to diet and fitness?
Okay, so I've always really enjoyed fitness and nutrition. Probably stems back to, I suppose, my mother getting sick with cancer, and so I learned a lot about nutrition then. And then going into university, I loved biology and found myself doing kinesiology anatomy courses, and lo and behold, went into medicine and chose a very musculoskeletal-based specialty. So knowing a lot about like fitness is really important professionally, but it's also just happened to be one of my hugest hobbies. I've always been known as the, I don't know, fit chick in the family, and that's had its ups and downs too. But I kind of found myself moving away from a healthy lifestyle as I approached the major test that I had to complete in the fall of this year. And I'd seen several colleagues go through the same thing and unfortunately spiral down into just gaining weight into their adult lives and never losing it. So I was getting a bit apprehensive, and I
Do
ended
you
up finding some time.
find
Go ahead.
that slightly ironic?
Yeah, because especially in our specialty where keeping in shape and exercises is one of our main kind of treatments and management for a lot of conditions. So I felt almost obligated not to let that happen to me.
Yeah,
So, yeah.
I find that slightly ironic. Healthcare practitioners who struggle with their own at least
See a lot of it.
the means. Obviously, like we can be succumb to illness that's out of our control, but it presents a bit of a trick for clients, I guess, patients, whatever you want to call it, when they see a practitioner who is themselves struggling with the things that they can control.
Exactly. But in like any high stress kind of job, and even going through the schooling and the residency, sleep deprivation from being on call, it's just no wonder why people find it really challenging to manage their diet and get those workouts in when they're just completely tired. So yeah, we see it happen a lot, and even though we should know better and take our own advice and our own medicine, quote unquote, sometimes we don't because we're just human too. So luckily, I had got myself up to speed with intermittent fasting the summer of 2010, and I had a lot of success with that, but the winter posed its own challenges, and I had some surgery and I couldn't exercise for a while then, and then I had a lot of stress with the studying coming up to the test, and I had a vacation, and I just didn't drop the weight after that as well, and it seemed to be going worse and worse. I also found fasting incredibly difficult to do when I was studying for my test, because I was in home and, that's where the food is. And so I just decided at least for a period of about 4 weeks right up coming up to the test, I wouldn't stress too much and let myself slide a little bit if I had to, but I was really anxious, increasingly so, that this was a bad move for myself, and I was on the lookout for a new program or some type of maybe like lifestyle thing that would really work and stick with me for a while. And I was lucky enough to have had the foresight to friend Brad Pienaar on Facebook, and surprisingly, he's a neighbor, 10 minutes away. When he posted something about Venus's gathering in Vegas back in May, I was really intrigued. I'm like, what is this Venus thing? And when I started reading up about the philosophy theories behind it, I thought, well, this is really, really interesting because I'm not gunning to be, a power lifter. I'm not an athlete, but I want to be fit, and having an appropriate waist ratio to height is consistent with all the research when it comes down to being healthy metabolically. So it would come along with health benefits while also coming along with just increased confidence from one's appearance. So I was like, I'm sold. And I bought it, and I started doing the workouts right away as soon as I wrote my first written test, but the tests were spread out over a course of 2 weeks, so I didn't actually tighten the belt on the diet until after the last test was done. And it was really hard to get back into fasting again. I had to kind of do 16, then 18, 20, then 24 hours, and eventually back to doing what I like to do, which is a 36-hour fast on Mondays, because Mondays just suck anyways.
And the 36-hour, it just fits for your schedule on a Monday?
Yeah, that I don't have to worry about packing anything in the morning on a Monday. I don't have to grocery shop on the weekend. And then I just, you know, go through my old day, some coffee or some water, Crystal Light, you know, the sort of thing. And
yeah.
Just go to the gym right after, just grin and bear it, get through it. And then when I come home, I'm basically tired enough that I can just, you know, hit the hay. And then Tuesday rolls around, and breakfast starting my day just makes me all right. I've tried 24-hour fasts, and occasionally I still do them, but I find I just tend to think about, how many things am I going to be eating at the end of the day, and I tend to overdo it. I tend to have less control in the evening hours, so for me it tends to work better if I do a 36-hour fast.
Interesting. So you find you have more temptation to overdo it after a 24 versus a 36?
It's just because of the time of day, I think.
Yeah, it's the psychology of it's a new day, it's morning, and it's just you just back on track the next morning.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess because you kind of have to plan a dinner, you have to kind of think, oh, what am I going to get? Whereas breakfast is always kind of like sitting in your cupboards and you know what you're going to eat, you know? So maybe that's part of it, too. I don't have to think about that breaking the fast and what that meal is going to comprise of.
Yeah, I think there's also some data, what you said about the evening being different. I think there's some data to suggest that our sense of smell and all of that just it becomes heightened towards the end of the day. So we're more likely to be, like you said, like want to overdo it at the end of the day versus the morning.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you're trying to like go later. Sleep deprivation is a killer, especially for cravings. That like carbohydrate sugar rush in the brain just keeps you stimulated and keeps you awake a little bit longer. So that's why people get those cravings and they want to eat. When they're tired, and at the end of the day, you're tired, right?
Right, so, yeah.
And so in the morning, you're likely to eat whatever you plan to eat for your breakfast and then just get on with your day, as opposed to in the evening, you're going to likely sit around the house or be in social events where you might continue having snacks or beverages available and get out of hand.
It's just a lot higher chance of going overboard in the evening. No, I agree. I bet you most people are the same. It's almost like you have to force yourself to overeat in the morning, whereas in the evening it's so much easier to do. So based on your schooling, you're obviously quite aware of human physiology. Was any of fasting or what we do, like you said, you already understood the height to waist ratio. Was any of this sounds like it wasn't really news to you? Was any of
well,
it like
the ESE learning about intermittent fasting over the summer of 2010 was news to me? Okay, I used to be so neurotic about eating every 2 to 3 hours. Like, I had those classic macrobiotically divided, protein-rich, low-carbohydrate, 6 meals a day planned out in a cooler to take with me to work. And yes, I'd be teased by my sisters, and I'd be teased by my colleagues at work, and it would really interrupt the flow of my day, because as doctors, we basically never stop to eat, or we just eat, you know, in between patients, and it's very unhealthy, actually. If you don't make the right choices, right? So it was a nuisance. It was a total drag.
So how long did you carry that on for? Or at least, what was
years.
The timeline of you learning it and then getting into it and all that?
Okay, well, I mean, I actually first stumbled across Joel Marion's Extreme Fat Loss Diet. And that one was a bit, you know, excessive, and I found that the cheat days turned into this total backwards day that just blew out the gains through the rest of the program, but it incorporated a full 36-hour day fast. And that's when I then found Brad Piemonte's study in the fall of 2010 and then started incorporating that better. And I still found that the 36 hours tend to work for me better. And yeah, life went on. So it was really weird the first couple times I did a fast. I thought that I was alone doing this, that people could tell that I was fasting and think it's wrong and give me their 2 cents and reprimand me for being so unhealthy. And, you know, I wasn't really concerned I was going to faint. Oh, maybe I was. I did carry like a safety package of almonds with me in case. But I kept up the fluids and I actually didn't need them. I just stayed out of the house. Those days, like the very first couple fasts, I just didn't even go home. I would like go from work to the gym to the library, go rollerblading, and then just come home and sleep. Like just wouldn't give myself an option to eat.
That's a good idea. Now, did you disclose this practice thing you were doing, fasting, to any of your colleagues?
Oh, God. It took me a long time, actually, before I did, and it was only to a select few. When it comes to different specialties, and the residents in different specialties have, I guess, generally different stereotypes or different personality traits that I think predispose them into those different roles.
Mm-hmm.
And dietary residents as a group are generally healthier, and a lot of them, like me, were bringing coolers of good food to work and everything as well. And in fact, some of our attendings were people who'd bike to work and jog and do marathons, that sort of thing. So, but yet I didn't hear of a soul doing this kind of intermittent fasting thing. So I thought I was being very risky and very bizarre. But when I found Eat Stop Eat, and I read all that research that was referenced, it was like, okay, here we go. There's the evidence-based research I was looking for, and I was completely satisfied after that. See, I had access through McMaster University's library online to all those articles, so I could read them and digest them myself and really convince myself that I wasn't putting myself at all in harm's way. Mm-hmm. But it still took plenty of time for my family to think so.
And then, like you said, you actually did disclose to a few colleagues that you thought might not...
Yeah, that were ready for it and mm-hmm. wouldn't, you know, tease me too much or whatever. But it hasn't actually picked up with them at all yet. So I don't know what keeps some people from doing it. I think some people just can't seem to get over the fear of it. There's even a few people who, when you tell them about the book, will even go out and buy it and read it. So it's kind of a shame because it's so simple. People say, oh, I hate calorie counting. I'm like, then don't calorie count. You know, just do this.
Yeah.
And it's just too simple a concept for them to give it a go.
So, but did you get any, like, negative pushback or just sort of, like, people like that who are just like, eh, whatever, it's not for them?
Well, I have a lot of family. I have a lot of sisters, actually. And some of them just chalk this up to another Tanya's eccentric traits. And, you know, one of them is really dead set against what I've been doing. It's taken her a long time to realize that I'm obviously not harming myself. I haven't keeled over and died yet.
Mm-hmm.
And she gives me plenty of negative kickback. Anyways, she's probably the only person I care who gives me negative feedback. The rest I just disregard and I continue doing whatever I think is better for me.
Mm-hmm. And then how do you deal with her?
How do you deal with sisters? You just try to reassure them. I've offered her the material plenty of time to read, but she's not interested. So I think it's just a matter of having patience with family members. Come on, we've all got those kind of siblings.
Oh, yeah. No, I know that that's like the basic, like that's the way to.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you'd come up with a better solution than that, but yeah, that's what we all kind of have to do.
I can just rely on my other siblings, or if you didn't have so many siblings, you could, you know, talk to your friends and just...
Right.
You know, somebody who gets you, that's going to support you through anything that you have
right.
to deal with.
Yeah,
and that's
okay.
Having a support network, oh my goodness, is that not the key to all of this? I'd say that the community is probably the best because I can gripe on there about people giving me flack for anything. And, you know, you're going to get some support and you're going to get some feedback, and it's fantastic.
Is it? Yeah, a few people have said that. Isn't it odd that we have to end up connecting with people from around the world through this medium to be supported on something that doesn't seem like it should need that kind of sophistication just to find people to support you? You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's too far and too few and far between in terms of people who are doing this lifestyle. it's very odd having an internet forum. I have never done this before, where I go on the internet and talk to people, aside from Facebook, but you don't really interact to this extent, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it was awesome. No negative comments whatsoever. And I found that it was a bit surreal. Like, do these people really exist? Why do they seem so real? You know, are they just like these abstract quantities that live in my computer box in cyberspace somewhere? But going to UNSUMMIT kind of solidified, you know, that these are real people, and it's just fantastic to get to know people in real life as well as online. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess, and you said it, it's too few and too far between. Now, based on the profession you're in, is that like, is there any kind of comment or just like a thought, like where have your thoughts evolved on that? Like the fact that it really is just too few and far between, and not just the fasting thing, but people who kind of just can take a rational, evidence-based approach to taking care of themselves.
Yeah, it's just odd. I think that a lot of physicians they're versed in how to review the literature and look at it for their clinical scenarios, the clinical problem at hand.
Mm-hmm.
But our specialty doesn't directly deal with weight loss. So knowing that a lot of it is psychological and we're physiatrists with the physical body, we tend to want to avoid having to get too psychological with them, with any patient, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not really our specialty and we weren't trained in that per se. But it impacts greatly a myriad of different musculoskeletal conditions like low back pain just sticks out as one huge example. And people with poor posture and neck and trapezius pain, and if they were just, you know, a bit more fit and had more muscular conditioning, then they would not suffer as much. I'm a total believer in that. And I think that if more people knew about this approach to eating, then it would be less common, these problems. And I've been sorely tempted, just newly starting my career, to encourage people to look up these resources. And yet I don't want to seem like I am pushing anything or, you know, and I don't know how people would take it. So it's very much in the infancy stages of seeing this as a useful resource for my patients to look up. So
mm-hmm. Do you almost feel like caught in a position where you think you've got I don't know if answer or solution is the word, but something that's of value that
some people might greatly benefit, absolutely. And I've had plenty of people since even, you know, getting placed in contest who've approached me and been like, how did you do that? What is this? How do you lose weight? You know, like as if it's a crazy concept that's never been done before. And when I tell them how I did it, where I went, where I got my resources, I don't know. So far, I haven't had too many people that have really picked it up. There's some people I think that might, but there's some people that I know are just asking because, I don't know, I guess they just want to seem as though they're interested in losing weight but don't actually want to do the work. So it's very frustrating.
Do you think that's part of it? It's just people have their own barrier, and even if you hand them what you know to be a quite useful answer or whatever, you can't force anybody to do anything. But
no, you can't.
Go ahead.
I think that people have this desire to achieve something, you know, say weight loss or increased muscle, and they want it, but they're not willing to put in the work. And they simply haven't, I think, really assessed all the reasons they want it badly in order to motivate themselves enough to do the hard work that needs to be done.
I've never heard anyone say it that way. I like the way you just said that. They haven't assessed it yet. I don't even know where we go from that. So can that even be brought into your practice, or is it, do you think it needs to be, I guess I'm really curious about your standpoint from as a physiatrist on how to.
I think.
What's
the
the
things
trick
like
to
I said,
getting people to get in shape?
They're
I mean,
like, what's
I'm
the trick
trying.
to
I'm
getting
trying to do
people
what
to
we do.
quit smoking? Oh my goodness, it's the same thing, right? What is the
Yeah.
trick in getting people to quit smoking? You have to. There's pre-contemplative stage. There's the contemplative stage, and then there's the action stage, and then there's maintenance. So a lot of people are just sitting in pre-contemplative stage, and you can't. You can tell them that this exists, and that there is a way, but until they're in the contemplative stage, they're not going to actually start to implement any of it.
Right.
So it's something has to click for them. And I'll tell people straight up, I'm like, you can lose weight. Anybody can lose weight. And there's resources that I could provide for you if you want to. But you'll have to show me that you're interested by, you know, coming back, you know, visiting me again and specifically requesting this. And you know, like that sort of, you have to see people step forward. You
Yeah.
can't just push it on them, you know?
Yeah, they have to be a willing. I always say they have to be a willing student. Otherwise, there's no point in trying to teach them. And
Yeah.
so now, is that something from as a medical practitioner? Do you have to make an assessment based on where you, like you said, the contemplative stage or wherever they are, and then you already know what kind of in your resource bag of tools, you already know which tools are useful or not because you can tell where they're at and
Absolutely.
which they'll take
Doctors
action on.
begin to get pretty good at taking in a variety of different characteristics of a patient and kind of just getting a gestalt sense of their prognosis, like whether they're going to do well and whether they're going to adhere to the program or to the treatment plan, or if they're not. And, you know, what are their values as well? Like, are they a less is more type of person? Do they want to put in, are they highly motivated or maybe not so highly motivated? Because then your treatment plan can differ. So, yeah, I mean, there's always an assessment of the patient and you try to match the treatment program properly.
Based
All I
on,
can
okay,
say.
I got you. No, that's what, kind of what I was trying to get at, like whether or not you're dealing with. A friend of mine described it as the difference between athletic therapy and physiotherapy. Athletic
Yes.
therapists typically deal with athletes
Highly motivated individuals.
who work their butt off to get back on the field, whereas in physio, you could end up with somebody, not always, but you could end up with patients who got hurt at work and maybe not really all that interested in getting back to work and kind of don't care about the therapy either.
Absolutely. And you see that all too often, even in my day-to-day practice. You have some people that have maybe a subconscious or not even realized reason that they might not want to get better, you know? And that's really unfortunate when you have a patient like that because it's going to be extremely hard to get them better. So.
So do you just have to dissociate yourself emotionally from, like, you can't force people to do anything and they'll just do what they're
No.
capable of doing?
Yeah, that's the unfortunate aspect of being a doctor. I think you really do come from a place of wanting to help people, and sometimes you know it's as simple as this, but then you have to realize that people have their own autonomy, they're going to make their own decisions, and whether it's right or if it's wrong, in your eyes, it's their right or wrong, and you just have to kind of take a breather and let it go sometimes. But there's plenty of instances. This is my mentality, and this is probably what keeps me going through a lot of aspects in life, where if things get you down, you just gotta take stock of all the good stuff. So there's going to be patients on the flip side that are going to be inspiring, that are going to be just wonderful people to have met, and they teach you so much, you know. So you gotta kind of remember those people and those patients. So make it
Right.
worthwhile to keep going.
Gotcha. Okay, so we detoured a bit here, so maybe we should get it back on the
Get
rails.
back. Well,
Yeah.
There's
Oh, I know.
correlates to.
I could talk. I would just as soon talk about this stuff the whole time, but I think people want to hear a bit at least about what you did with the contest and your own personal stuff. So you're. I don't know. Where are we next here? Like, want to work through.
I think we should get to the meat of this stuff. I think if
Yeah.
people want to know how I made my progress happen, how I dropped about 10 pounds of fat and reined in about 7 inches in those three areas, you know, shoulders, waist, and hips. I did that basically by, you know, reading all the material and thinking on a weekly basis. And that was a big game changer for me. I think a lot of people have already said that. But basically, if I have one day that's just totally backwards, I can still, if I work really hard, make it a good week. So
right.
The concept of forward, neutral, and backwards days was great. I even added in advanced days as being days which were less than 500 calories, or, you know, like a fast day would even count in that regard.
Hmm.
And I made sure that I had a list of very low-calorie foods and beverages and recipes and another list of things I would allow myself to have on a fasting day, so I could just kind of alternate between different flavors of tea and Crystal Light and what have you. I found that having a upbeat playlist at the gym that I constantly would update with new music was great to motivate me if my energy was really flagging. And then the podcasts were fantastic because they taught me a lot, and it's almost like, I call it healthy brainwashing. I just like listen to that stuff when I'm doing other things. I just kind of get my brain, you know, imbued with all these little tips and tricks and different way of conceptualizing things. Like, remember that one podcast that said the hunger pains of this one guy, he said it was like, this is the feeling of fat burning, or, you know, this is what fat burning feels like. That's what he said. So those are all very good. I also kept my gym bag packed and ready to go in my house or in my car. And I'd often just go straight from work to the gym. Screw the hungry. I just would drink some more Crystal Light or some water and just do it. I think the biggest thing was just making a good concrete list of my motivators, reasons, and things that kept me on track. And if I ever felt that I was getting off track, I'd, you know, read it and revise it if I needed to, and, you know, add to it if I could, so that it gets stronger and stronger.
Okay, and then did you at any point start recognizing the concept of the cumulative effect of multiple forward days?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's very obvious when I look at my calendars, and the colors on the calendars, because it would be red for a backwards day, blue for a neutral, and green for forward, that as I have more of the greens, I'd be making progress, and it just was completely obvious. It took a little while, but it was obvious where I was going wrong, because I did 2 weeks of eating just whatever I felt like I wanted to in a stressful period of my life in top of May, and recording those calories before I actually started reining my diet in. So I knew that I was eating well above my basal metabolic rate, not doing very much activity. So that's where I was going wrong. And I guess that's the way I eat in order to get that. And so I had to eat a different way in order to lose the fat. And now I'm trying to learn to eat it another way to stay at this level. So.
Oh, yeah, maintenance is a whole other trick. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what was the, I don't know, let's get into what were your biggest challenges throughout your change?
Oh, my goodness. So I didn't even, my biggest challenge right at the beginning was the stress of the test, because I was in the process of doing the test. And I said, okay, well, I have to start somewhere. And so I thought to myself, restricting the food is going to be really hard for me. I just know myself. I'm in the house every day studying and study group. I'd have my study buddies over and be eating pizza. And I'm like, well, I don't realistically think that I'm going to be winning at that. So I'm going to try to make a success by the simple fact of me starting the program, the workouts. So I got on track with getting those workouts in, hell or high water, I got them in. I would schedule that time to go to the gym for my workout 3 times a week. After my study groups, even if I was mentally very tired, because it was just great to start moving again, because it's like 8 hours a day of just sedentary study.
Mm.
And it felt really good, and feeling sore afterwards was like this reminder that I'd done something physical for my body, and right. And after, you know, doing that consistently, I could say, you know, pat myself on the back and say, you know what, at least I'm working on consistently again, and I can feel it in my muscles, so I'm doing something good for myself. And then it was just you know, when I felt I was ready to, after the stress of the test was behind me, even though I didn't know what the results were yet, I said, okay, now there's no excuses. You can fast. You don't have to study. You're not in the house. You can go outside, go for a walk. You can go shopping or whatever. You can distract yourself, and you can fast. You can cut your calories low. You can do this. And after getting through a couple days of that, you know, you can pat yourself on the back about that one, you know, and then you can start gunning for a lower weekly total calorie goal and challenging yourself that way. And if you just keep tracking your measurements, then you can tell that you're going the right direction.
So you added those things in stages?
In stages, yeah. I think for people who don't like working out, then just working on the diet first is probably going to get them changes that they can notice quicker and motivate them better. But at the time, I just knew my situation. I had to start with the workouts first because the diet was going to be, at that time, more difficult to control. Mm. But I didn't let that continue because otherwise I know I wouldn't have seen progress. I had in the past, before I found out about intermittent fasting, been an exerciser. And I was doing so much exercise. Like, I'd be a morning runner, 5K, 8K every morning. My ex-boyfriend, he was, you know, upset that I was never in bed in the morning because I was always outside running. And I felt I had to do that. I felt that I had no control over my weight if I wasn't in constant motion. And I actually didn't even have a car at the time, so I was walking between all the hospitals and biking up and down the escarpment here in Hamilton. And I was always trying to increase the amount of calories out, but I wasn't really focusing strongly enough on the calories that were coming in. And I was a bit like orthorexic, I think it's called, where, you know, it has to be good food, good quality food. And I get really down on myself if I was eating not good food, like ice cream and chocolate and things like that, which now I don't even flinch at because it's just calories.
So that's interesting. So you seem to be OCE in both cases, obsessive compulsive mm-hmm. eating and obsessive compulsive exercising.
Yeah. It was a brutal way to live. It took a lot of energy out of my life. And
for sure. Like mental energy and actual physical energy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I went through a tough breakup, and then I actually ended up getting into a new relationship in a period of time where I was actually almost not wanting to because I was trying to study for this big exam. But I think, you know, if things like that happen when they're going to happen, you don't really have control over them. And if you want to make it work, you're going to make it work. So I had to balance a couple different juggling balls at the time with the studying and working and a new relationship and going out. So there was that social aspect as well. So I had to save time for that. And once we started really to get to know each other, and after the exam was over and I started actually exercising more and maybe not indulging so much with the food as I started getting tighter with the calories, I think my boyfriend went to the stage where he was like, whoa, are you like a crazy fitness chick? And I'm like, I told you I was. But I just had been so involved with study that it was not noticeable. So right. there was a barrier there for a little while of gaining understanding and acceptance from my partner that this was, you know, a healthy thing to do, that this was an okay thing to do, because at first he thought it was maybe not so much those things to do. Mm. But I think he was just a bit concerned for my well-being, and once time just went on and he realized that this wasn't that owner, like not too crazy in terms of the time that it required me to do, and it wasn't affecting me physically with my health in a negative way, then he began to relax. And now he may be in a stage where he's moving from pre-contemplation to contemplation himself, and perhaps in the future doing something of the same idea, going into a program and doing it consistently for a while to see what kind of results he gets. But
That's interesting. This is the first time I've ever even contemplated or thought of what the consequences or what would happen when getting into a new relationship but living this kind of lifestyle, and especially I'd never even thought of that, like meeting somebody and then they're like, wait a minute, you fast? Like, hang on a sec, what's going on here?
Yeah, no, it was It was weird. We had a lot of heated discussions.
I never thought about like people was like, what kind of baggage is this? I mean, are you kidding me? I'm dating this girl, and you won't believe it, but she just doesn't eat for date. Like, he must have thought you had an eating disorder or something.
Yeah, no, he thought that I was on a slippery slope to, like, anorexic or something, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
I've always been, like, a healthy weight. There was a period of time in the far past when my mother was very ill, and we were eating extremely healthy, and I still was doing all that kind of running and exercise because it was a way to deal with the stress as well, where I got to a really low weight, but I still wasn't anorexic. I just didn't have enjoyment from food. And this was before I was even anywhere thinking of going into medical school, before I even could self-diagnose myself with depression. But certainly was the case, and it resolved itself. So there was no negative consequence to my health long-term, and that was okay. But yeah, my parents, my family, thus are still holding on to this idea like I might revert to an unhealthy weight like that was, but the stimulus is not there. The same environment of sadness is not there, so I don't see it as being a problem. But I still have to deal with them always kind of being overly cautious for me and overly protective. So it's a bit of a difficult thing to try to reassure people and demonstrate that you are healthy and that you're well and there's nothing wrong with the way you're living your life. And it's tough. Like, nobody gets down on my sister, who happens to be overweight. And she knows she's overweight, and she knows it's unhealthy, and she has negative health consequences from it. But nobody gets down on her for that, but they're more likely to kind of, you know, reprimand me for losing a couple pounds. So it's a bit of an unfair game.
On its face, I can see how the actions, without knowing what's going on in your head and knowing you're actually, you know, that whatever the depressive issues are resolved and the emotions are in check, or without knowing that your mental state of mind is healthy now, on its face, all they can see is, well, back then she didn't eat and now she's not eating. This must be the same thing. They can't tell that it's just a calculated, evidence-based. You're just like, yeah, no, I'm just, you know, like, you're in control of it, whereas, you know what I mean? Like, I can see how they look at the behavior, and they can't tell on the inside you're in control.
I think it's just a matter of time. It's a matter of maintaining what this is for a couple of years and showing them that this is a lifestyle, that it has improved my life, has made me more confident, has made me more physically fit. I can do more with my body, walk longer, climb better. Not that I have to use that skill all that often, but I've never had such upper body strength before, so I'm still lagging behind some of the ladies on the forum, but that's fine. And, you know, there's certain perks to this that I'm appreciating these days, and they have to just see that there's nothing negative about what I'm doing. I actually can let myself enjoy a family gathering's food feast. I'm not telling them, oh, sorry, I can't eat that because that's not part of my diet. And, oh, sorry, I can't eat that because I've already eaten too much today. Like, I don't have to act that way because the way, you know, Eat, Stop, Eat and Anything Goes diet is structured that you can choose when you want to enjoy yourself a little bit with more calories versus a little bit less. And it's actually very freeing. So you don't have to feel over food anymore. It's great.
Yeah, and I think you said it best. It's the only way to really get them comfortable that you are okay, so to speak, is time. That just as the months and years go by, they're like, oh, yeah, maybe she is fine, and it was us that had the wrong idea, not in, you know, that's...
Yeah, it's the change that they notice. It's the change that they notice that they get freaked out by. But as it maintains in a tight, fluctuating maintenance range, like level, that my weight and, you know, everything, then they will see that this is just, they'll become accustomed to it. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just years of experience the other way. Now they just need to you need to pile up years of experience this way, and then they're like, oh, okay, yeah, right. This is her. Yeah.
But I just want to put a plug in there, though, that weight in many women's lives is neither simply always really thin or quite big. It fluctuates, and I've been as low as like 105 and as high as 147. So it's funny how nobody was on my case when I was almost going to the 150s and stuff like that on my 5 foot, 5.5 inch frame. I mean, it was heading to a place of being very unhealthy, and nobody was concerned at that point. So it's interesting.
Yeah, nobody has that reaction. I think it's so, mm-hmm. it's social taboo to just look, point at someone and say, "Yeah, I think you got 20 pounds to lose or 30 pounds to lose." Even mm-hmm. even when that that opinion is solicited, it's still hard to say it. Like, I've had girls ask me that. They're like, "What do you honestly think? Like, what do I need to do? Like, you know, maybe to get to VI." And I'm like, "Oh, well, maybe can you ask somebody else? Because I don't actually want to." Like, the answer sucks. if the answer is that, well, you know, based on your measurements and based on what we've done with other people, you've got, you know, 18 pounds to lose. Like, that's the worst.
Heck, it's even hard for a doctor to add that into the suggestion for a management of a condition. You know, and your heel spur pain, plantar fasciitis, it will be greatly reduced by losing weight. Some people, it's just making it really hard for themselves to get better.
Mm, yeah. I think I've with Venus, there's at least a way. To me, so far, it's the first time I've ever found a way to be actually say this sort of thing to girls. It's as disarming as it can get, even though it's still not totally disarmed. It's mm-hmm. kind of like, well, here are the metrics. And then, you know, once you get curious, you're like, well, what do you think? What do you think I'd have to weigh to get to that? And I'm like, well, you know, based on the numbers. And then it becomes more of this mathematical. I try to take the. Depersonalize it, make it like, well, kind of like this just math thing. I don't know. It tries mm-hmm. And then you take it or leave it. It's like, well, that's just our metrics. If you think they're bogus, then that's fine. But that's just what we, you know, that's just a calculation or whatever you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the easiest way I've found to actually have that conversation with women.
Yeah, I imagine it would be. Phrasing it in a way that doesn't put them on the spot is really helpful to get a message across without putting a person on the defense. And mm-hmm. not having a person on the defense increases your likelihood that message is going to be received.
Mm, exactly. And then the metrics, and part of the depersonalizing it is all I do is ask for the height, and it's like, oh, you know, I'm 5'5". I'm like, okay, so a 5'5" woman, and so I stop talking about them, and I just start talking about the mythical 5'5" woman.
Exactly.
And I'm like, well, yeah. And then that way, clearly I'm talking to them about them, but it's, you know, it's all that, like, humans don't really tell the truth. They just use innuendos just so they're off the hook and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways.
Funny. That's so true. No, so it's great to talk in terms of metrics as opposed to pounds. I mean, I've kept an eye on pounds as well, but it's so quick and easy to take my myotape measurement and cinch around my waist and tell if I'm kind of in the right spot. And it just means a lot more because nobody can tell by looking at you how much you weigh, but they can look at you and see what your shape is. So if they're going to have, you know, these unavoidable biases about you when they look at you, you want them to be as positive as they can be, which I would like to hope that is VI shape. Unfortunately, there's both the pros and the cons to achieving a VI shape, and I think as you get there, you start to learn more about them. And I think it's why some people get hooked up on sabotage points is because they're going through a process of weighing those pros and cons and whether they want to proceed closer to VI. You know, so it's been interesting. And I really look forward to you or Brad Howard kind of going ahead and making an e-book and discussing the Venus effect, you know, and what social implications are involved with having that shape.
The podcast is already done. It's just not out yet.
Sweet.
Well, as we're recording this, we've already recorded it. It'll probably go up next week. So this will be completely out of this. I don't even know why I'm saying this now because you guys will all have probably heard it by the time I'm saying this. So, anyways, but I think did you start the Venus Effect thread?
Yeah, I did.
We can talk a little bit about that if you want to talk about that. Like,
I think a lot of women are very curious about sabotage points and you know. If I had them and what I thought, I guess they might want to hear about that. I think the 120 mark pound wise was a sabotage point for me. Getting into the teens signified being in the skinny range of when I was depressed, I guess. I hadn't actually remembered that it was as low as 105 and around the 100s until I recently got a hold of some old journals. But I'd always thought that that was the teens. And so when I was breaching the 120 and realizing that I'd be dipping into those numbers, I guess I brought up a lot of the emotional kind of sadness about that period of time. And it took a while to realize that I wasn't going to become that sad person. I wasn't going to become that very sad, very skinny, bony, pointy. My sister would call me too pointy to hug kind of girl. Girl, not woman. So it was that was a bit of a psychological hurdle to overcome. And, yeah, it took a little bit, but I had realized that I was no less attractive to my boyfriend. I didn't look at all in the mirror like I used to then. I had, you know, womanly curves where I needed them, and I wasn't in danger of losing them because I was building muscle in all the right places. So I just kind of had some faith and kept going, you know, trying to reassure myself with those comments in my in my head, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the danger of worrying about what the scale weight says, because like you said, the quality of that weight and your shape at that weight and your body composition at that weight and what your the shape of your body means socially and to yourself, it's just a number on the scale doesn't say at all what your shape is, what your composition is, how it looks, like how it makes you feel. Like it's that's why that number is kind of meaningless, and the sooner we can disassociate ourselves or emotionally get away from looking at that and caring about those numbers, the better. Because like look at the I mean, you still had to do significant you had to relearn to be at that weight.
Absolutely. And it's just it's never before something that I tracked, you know. I never before tracked those measurements, really. So it's been a freeing concept to have a different metric to measure your progress with. And pictures, oh my goodness, pictures have been helpful as well. Just doing them consistently. Sometimes you don't want to, but if you do them, then you can see where changes are happening, because I'm getting to that point of diminishing returns, and it's getting very difficult to see the progress, but there's still small progress happening, so I'll take it.
Well, yeah, and like you said, you're closer to maintenance or onto maintenance now, so the pictures can, I think, and a few people have said this now in previous interviews I've done, where the picture is easier to be objective about yourself in a picture than the mirror, because we just can't disassociate ourselves when we're looking at ourselves in the mirror. But as soon as you see a picture, you're like, oh, that's what I actually look like.
Yeah, I'm actually wondering if I can get some type of tool on my computer in order to like measure, you know, widths and diameters and do calculations, but I'm not that tech savvy, so I just actually was curious whether you may have used that yourself in trying to tease out your winners for the Venus contest, because I imagine it was really, really hard for you.
Yeah, I'm enjoying judging these contests less and less. It's just, it's tough. I don't really want to get into it. It's just really hard to, everyone deserves something, but there's only so many spots, and it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's the level two is going to be like really unpleasant to judge, because everyone's going to be in amazing shape, and I'm going to be finding any reason to not place people, right? Because somehow someone has to beat somebody else. So, a note about the contest: I really hope people have enough wherewithal, or I don't know what the word is, security to not hang their hat on where they place. I mean, the fact that anyone improves and changes, that's the win. The contest is just this sort of fun construct to add in accountability and motivation, but you can't ever hang your head. Even in our contest, I know I say this about real bodybuilding shows and real fitness shows, because their judges have very specific criteria, and it changes from show to show, and there's politics. But even with ours, you can't let where you place really change your opinion of yourself. The fact that anyone improves, that's the point is improvement. That's all the point is. And this is just a vessel to help facilitate the improvement.
You know, it's all too funny about the contest. I vaguely remember seeing this announcement that it was going to start, but I was, you know, a day before my final test, and so I didn't really pay attention to it. And then a day or two after that was done, I was on the forum checking it out. I was like, oh, there's this contest going on. Do I do I go into one? Do I actually do a contest? I've never done one before. And I'm like, well, what harm could it do? Come on, it's not a big deal. And I kind of like goaded myself into doing it. I actually felt like by submitting into this contest, I would feel like I'm counting myself in as a Venus, as part of this group. So, and that was important to me because I thought, you know, these ladies that won in the first contest, they're women who did a lot of hard work to achieve what they achieved, and that is commendable. And I'd love to count myself in that group. So I said, okay, I'm gonna enter. And of course, I get hazed by my boyfriend, and he's like, you don't need to change. And I'm like, well, you know, I just want to see. I think I'm good, but I want to be better. You know, I just want to see what I can do. I want to challenge my body. And it was interesting. It was always a back of my mind type of thought through the contest period. But I didn't go, you know, really, really crazy about being hardcore. Like, Alicia's podcast was totally inspiring, and yet not at all what I could have pulled off during those many weeks that followed and all the celebratory get-togethers because I passed and all the visiting of family that I'd been neglecting for months. I just couldn't have done it so strictly, and I had to really work my weekly calories around big events. And when it came down to the 12th week, I just was like, oh, is that today? I got to do it. You know, I got to finish something that I started. And I was a bit unprepared. I'd let time get away on me. I could have maybe done it the day before, but I was at 10 p.m. thinking, I need to get this done. So I knocked on my neighbor's door to beg for a newspaper, and I snapped up a couple of pictures and got in it under the wire. I'm very, very happy that I did because it was, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Just evidence that something I did resulted in a socially recognized achievement.
I like how you chose all those words.
It was like, holy smokes. Some people actually thought I did something good. You know, it's because, I mean, you know, you don't hear it anywhere else. Like, my boyfriend said, oh, you look great before, you look great now. He didn't, it happened very slowly. He almost like didn't even notice that anything was changing at all. And well, he shouldn't even comment because, you know, guys can get themselves into plenty of trouble if they comment on women's bodies. So I wasn't going to get any feedback there. And my family members, I don't know, they don't really notice those small changes. And they just say I look good, and that's that. So, I mean, to hear from, like, a contest that, you know, you did really well compared to all these people that you highly respect made me, you know, really stand up and take measure of what I did for myself, and I don't think I would have, I don't know, appreciated the work that I did put in if I had in place, because I would have been just like, well, I finished what I started, that's good. But, you know, now that I did, I was like, wow, I can do something.
Yeah.
I know, it was a really wonderful feeling.
Yeah, and it's all relative too, right? Like, some people, I'm sure some people with further room to go would look at your before picture and go, well, she's in really good shape, but it's, you know, why does she feel like doing anything? Kind of like how you said your boyfriend's, well, you look good then, you look good now.
My one sister said specifically, I didn't think you could have before pictures. I didn't think you have before pictures. Like, she was like, why did you even place? You didn't change. And I'm like, well, it wasn't exactly the transformation part of the contest. It was the open. They still didn't get it.
But there's the point is, if you feel like you want to do some more improvement on your body, that you should have the right to do that. It's not everyone else's opinion on if everyone else is in not as good shape as you, and they look to your before picture and they're like, well, what, I would kill for that. But you're like, yeah, well, so what? I still wouldn't mind doing a bit more work here. So everyone has the right to want to improve their body if they choose to. And it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's, but a lot of people who, kind of like the naysayers and other people who aren't on board yet, they might, it's the crabs in a bucket thing. Like, wherever you are seems good enough to them. So then they're like, why doesn't that seem good enough to you? And for everybody who's making a change, it's your prerogative. If you want to have a ripped six pack, I don't care. I can help you do that. And it's nobody's business but yours if that's what you want. So just as an example, right, of taking things to an even more to another level. So the VI thing to me is people can get as close to it as they want and then try to recomposition while they're at it. And it's nobody's business but your own.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I totally understand that sense of, self-directed choice. And, I've got patients, and when I tell them what their treatment options are, one of them is simply to do nothing. To just choose to do nothing. So some people just choose to do nothing, or they don't want to put the work in. But anyways, I thought it might be good to comment on, I'm just thinking something that, a big mental change, I think, happened as well, that now that I've reached a shape that I'm satisfied with, it's been a big mental game changer, because now it's like if I flip through a fitness magazine or if I see a fitness model or whatever, I'm not like kind of wishing I looked like that, which is a really sad way to go through your entire life, wishing that you look like somebody else. And now it's like, no, I'm actually really happy with my body. I mean, yeah, I could get a little bit better, but I don't want my body to be somebody else's anymore. I just want it to be my best body. And that's fantastic, because I know there's so many women out there, because I was one for so many years, that are just totally wishing and desiring to look like someone is in a magazine or some celebrity. And with all the Photoshop effects stuff, that's an unattainable goal. And it's really nice when you can have a sense of, like, real satisfaction with what you have, what you've got to live
totally.
In.
Totally. You can flip to your picture and be like, I want to look like that. You go, oh, wait, that's me. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
I'll just take that then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're right. And there's some degree of, I guess, peace or calm that comes with that once you're happy with your body and not worried about trying to be somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we've been at it for about an hour now. Do you have more?
There's just one more thing I probably thought would be useful for some people. I've never had much of a hard time getting myself to the gym and doing my workouts. I only did the base program, the 12-week cycle 1, 2, 3, but I did them consistently. And I didn't even add on too much extra cardio. I just did maybe some walks, some rollerblading, and I do ballroom dancing, which is only like an extra hour and a half a week. And the thing is, getting to the gym consistently, it's key, because muscle needs to be stimulated in order to grow and change. And sometimes it's just so hard being, working and studying, and you're just exhausted by the end of the day. But if you schedule it into your calendar, and I've got my Google Calendar tricked out to the max. It's got so many different calendars and colors going on, so I can keep track of different things with the click of a button. That if you get scheduled in and you make time for it, and you have your gym bag packed and ready to go, and your playlist is good, then you just go. You just go, and you don't even give yourself a choice. You just get in the car and you get there. And then once you're there, because I find it a lot easier to work out in a gym in an environment where everybody else is working out. Same thing with studying. The library is really easy as opposed to staying at home. But once you're there, you just tell yourself, okay, well, what is the first exercise? Don't look at the whole thing. Just look at the first exercise and look at it, and you're like, okay, well, I'll give it a go. If I think it's tough, maybe I'll go with maybe just a little bit lighter weight than I did last time. And I'll just give it this one exercise. And if I do the first, 10 minutes and I'm liking it, I'll keep going. But if not, you know what, I came all the way here, I gave it a go, and I'll go home. But it almost never works out that, I just give up at that point. But it helps. It's like mental trickery. It's just the one more step or just the one more day kind of phenomenon that gets you through things when you put the blinders on and only look at a small portion of the whole thing.
Yeah, you baby step it. You don't even want to see what the next 20, you don't even want to see what the next full hour has in store. You just want to see what the next 5 minutes has.
Yeah, absolutely. And it ticks on. It ticks on. The time just goes by. Some people wonder how I managed to pull off 11 post-secondary years of education. And I just say, well, those 11 years were going to roll by regardless. So I might as well have been using it to get to where I am now, because I'm very happy where I am right now. And it was a lot of hard work. But after the first year, I was like, I'm not going to let all that hard work go to waste. Like, it was a brutal first year. My mom, she even looked at me, and she was like, are you going to go back? I'm like, hell yeah. I'm not going to let all that time and effort go to waste. So if you're going to commit to a contest or work a program and just keep doing it. Don't let it go to waste.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know if it's the right phrase. I just call it shortening your time horizon. So instead of trying to look at the next 10 years or even the next 10 months, shorten it down. And if you have to, shorten it, like you said, all the way down to the next 10 minutes. And if that's mm-hmm. what keeps you moving, as long as you have a plan, don't look at the whole thing. Just look at the next however much you think you can digest. And that might be the, like you said, mental trickery. I like that. That might be the only way to get through some of these sort of things.
Absolutely. So, thank you so much.
Thanks for being on the call.
Interviewing me, and this has been just wonderful to maybe put some stuff out there that I hope has been helpful for those that are listening. And I just want to say to all my Venus sisters, thank you for all your help and support. And John Barban and Brad Guillon, thank you for your brain children, these wonderful tools that have like really kind of helped me get everything together and given me a lot more confidence that I know how to control my weight and my shape. And it's great.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the call. So for Tanya Enriquez, I'm John Barban, and that's your Venus Index Podcast.